90.1 FM in Burnaby, British Columbia, broadcasting from the unceded territories of the Coast Salish peoples. Find us online at cjsf.ca, on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, and SoundCloud.
Welcome to Guerrilla Radio, recorded May 17th, 2023. While the status of Crimea is becoming the main issue forbidding peace between Russia and the NATO-backed government in Kyiv, Canada's official position, one shared by its NATO partners, treats the peninsula as occupied territory, referring to the 2014 referendum on joining Russia as unconstitutional and therefore invalid. For his part, Ukraine President Volodymyr Zelensky said last week, quote, "The world should know respect and order will only return to international relations when the Ukrainian flag returns to Crimea." Needless to say, Russia sees things differently. Dan Kovalik is a lawyer, educator, labor, peace and justice activist, democracy defender, journalist, author, and filmmaker. He's just returned from an extended research mission in Russia, including travels throughout Crimea. Dan's observed elections in Venezuela, Nicaragua, and Colombia. His book titles include Cancel This Book, The Progressive Case Against Cancel Culture, the Plot 2 series on American efforts to undermine the governments and economies of Iran, Venezuela, and Russia, No More War, How the West Violates International Law by Using Humanitarian Intervention to Advance Economic and Strategic Interests, and his recently released Nicaragua, A History of U.S. Intervention and Resistance. Dan Kovalik in the first half. And the epochal events roiling our world may seem to us to be all of the moment, but they are merely more of the same found ever under the sun. History waxes and wanes just as fortune capricious turns the magnificent to meanness in a twinkle. It is all illusion, a bubble blown and popped and done. What endures are words of wisdom, verse uttered on a stage, prose printed on the page. It's a great and humbling realization to know our times will seem someday to some others as so many tempests in a char's pail. And if that sounds to you like so much philosophy and all too poety, you ain't heard nothing yet. Kim Goldberg is a Nanaimo-based poet, journalist, and author. She's written 8 books of poetry and nonfiction, including her most recent collection, Devolution, Poems and Fables of Ecopocalypse. Kim is playing host this Saturday, May 20th, in Nanaimo, to Poetry of Resilience, a gathering of lettered presenters at the Harborfront Library branch. It will feature 15 local poets and musicians sharing their vision of resilience through word and song. Kim Goldberg with the Constant Poets in the second half. But first, Dan Kovalik and Crimea as Crucible of the Russia-Ukraine War. Well, welcome back to the program, Dan.
Hey, thanks for having me, Chris.
Well, it's always my great pleasure, of course. Now Dan, can we begin with the prosaic? Just how does one travel from America to Russia and back these days?
Well, there's actually 3 ways to go. So the way that I know of, the way I went is I flew to Helsinki, which is easy. So that's, you know, a standard flights you can take and get on major airlines. And then you can take a bus. It takes about 6 hours into St. Petersburg. So that's what Russia. So that's how I went. And then but you can also fly direct from the U.S. on Turkish Airlines through Istanbul to Moscow, and the same on Emirates airline as well. So you have to take those foreign airlines, a couple of them, to get there. So that's, I guess, 2 different ways. And then the third is you can go through Serbia as well. So it's not easy to get there. And if you do the non-Helsinki routes, it's very expensive because they're really gouging people to get there. So that's the long and short of it.
And the same coming home. And this is, of course, because of the sanctions, another feature of the belligerence that's gone on between the United States and Russia, even prior to the outbreak of hostilities in Ukraine.
Yes, but it's really been since the breakout in hostilities in February of last year that you have this very big break in travel between Russia and the West. For example, even if you go to Helsinki, there used to be, of course, a famous train that would take you to Finland Station in St. Petersburg, right? That train is not operating because of the sanctions. So, yeah, I mean, Russia is largely now cut off from the West. And also, you pretty much have to bring all the cash you need for your trip, even for hotels, because you cannot use credit cards there or ATM cards. So you need to basically bring all the cash you need for the time you're there.
This is a kind of like a throwback to days of yore. What about traveler's checks? Are those even still a thing?
Yeah, I haven't even heard those are still a thing. But again, those wouldn't work either if you had U.S. traveler's checks. I'm certain if they are still a thing, and I did used to use those wouldn't work. So you bring your dollars, and then you can convert those dollars to rubles in Russia.
Yeah, and what's the conversion rate like these days?
Well, when we were there, it was about 80 to 1. So you get for $1, you got 80 rubles, which is a pretty good exchange rate. So things were fairly affordable. But, you found your rubles pretty quickly, actually. You know, and for the first few days, it's like you have Monopoly money. You just spend it like crazy, and you realize, oh, geez, I just spent a lot of money.
So. Wait, it's real. Well, I mean, I mentioned that because that was one of the main issues. You heard it on Capitol Hill in the U.S., that the boast was that America was going to crash the Russian economy in retribution for the temerity of stepping in to protect the Donbass.
Yeah, and that really hasn't happened. I mean, obviously, there's been some businesses and certain entrepreneurs that have been hurt by this, right? Obviously, if you were trading only with the West or whatnot, you could be, you know, very much hurt by this. But in general, it hasn't taken a big dent out of the economy, and certainly the cities are thriving. I was in St. Petersburg, Moscow, and went to Crimea and to a few cities there. And, you know, people are out, they're shopping, they're going to restaurants, they're going to cafes. There's no indication that, you know, that there's a great economic collapse or anything from the sanctions.
Well, you wouldn't know that to listen to the Ukrainian president, who just the other day in a television appearance, not only did he promise that there would be no peace until Crimea, the Ukrainian flag was flying over Crimea, but he said that the Ukrainians would have to go and rebuild all the destruction Russia has wrought in Crimea, and also saying that, well, they're financially in a mess and they're their tourist industry is entirely collapsed. What were your impressions being there?
Yes, I had the total opposite impression, and I think reality is the total opposite of what he's saying. I mean, first of all, the Russians have not done any destruction in Crimea. To the extent there's been destruction, it was Ukraine after Crimea had this referendum in March of 2014 to reunite with Russia. Crimea cut off electricity, or sorry, Ukraine cut off electricity to Crimea. There, you know, people in Crimea didn't have electricity for 8 months. They cut off water. They dammed a river that fed Crimea and from which people got water, and the reservoir got water. Russia actually bombed that dam early on in the special military operations, and now the water is flowing into Crimea. And Russia's doing a lot of construction and development work in Crimea. I mean, Crimea even was neglected by Ukraine before this 2014 because it was largely, you know, it's largely a Russian-speaking population, and as is the Donbass. And the truth is the government in Ukraine, again, beginning with the coup in 2014, really had no interest in those peoples. And, you know, the reason the people in Crimea and the Donbass, you know, voted to go their own way in 2014 was because the first thing that the government in Ukraine did, the coup government in 2014 did, was to outlaw Russian. And again, in these Russian-speaking areas, that was a non-starter. And people felt under attack, felt their culture under attack, and that's why they went their own way. And a war broke out between the government in Kiev and the Donbass, but not Crimea. I mean, for the most part, they have not been attacked, although recently they have. In fact, there have been a number of drone attacks by Ukraine on Crimea in recent weeks. We witnessed one, actually, as we were coming into Crimea on the train. So the way we got to Crimea, by the way, we took a 27-hour train from Moscow to Crimea. which is the only way you can get there. Well, you can drive as well. You have to go by ground because the airspace is closed because there are these, you know, kind of limited terrorist attacks, really, by Ukraine against Crimea.
And it wasn't the Russians then that blew up the Kerch bridge after all.
Right, that was Ukrainians. Ukrainians did that as well, which people should know. So what is that bridge? So up until the Kerch bridge was built several years ago by the Russians, that what that did is that created a bridge from Russia proper into Crimea, which hadn't existed anymore. So we took the train over the Kerch Bridge. Prior to that bridge being built, the way you would get to Crimea was to drive or take a train through Ukraine, or you could fly as well. But the only ground way was through Ukraine. So the Russians built that bridge so that you didn't have to go through Ukraine to do that. And yes, it was Ukraine that ended up bombing that bridge. Was it last summer? But the Russians repaired it very, very quickly. And again, we took that train over the bridge when we went.
Well, and it's a engineering marvel. All politics aside, there was a lifting bridge built in my city, Victoria, some years ago. It's about 80 or 100 feet across, and it cost $100 million and took a couple of years to do. And yet for those that aren't aware of what the Kerch Bridge is, what are its rough dimensions, having traveled across it? Can you describe it?
Yeah, I mean, it's very large. I couldn't tell you how long it is. I mean, I want to say it's significant. I want to say it may be quarter mile or something like that. It's a huge bridge. Yeah, it is amazing to go over it. And it's really a lifeline for people now because it is the only way to get into Crimea effectively these days.
And it's got a road platform and a train, obviously, segment as well. And it was hit by a suicide bomber in a 5-ton truck full of explosives, and who timed it to blow up the train at the same time as taking out a big section of the roadway and collapsing it into the sea. And as you say, in just a year's time, it's been repaired and less than that, actually, and operable again, which is a testament to the engineering capabilities and the determination of Russia.
And the will to do it. I mean, Russia, I mean, the truth is putting a lot of money into Crimea. And interestingly, not just, by the way, for the Russian, the ethnic Russians there, we also saw a huge mosque being built there that the Russian government is actually sponsoring, the building of a mosque for the Tatar people who live in Crimea. And a lot of people talk about the Tatars and say, oh, well, they didn't really want to go back to Russia, but I think they're pretty happy back with Russia at this point. So, and again, before the special military operation started in February 2022, you could find a lot of mainstream press, and you can Google this, that said, well, you know, the truth is the Crimeans are very happy being part of Russia. And I don't know if you want to go through the history of Crimea and Russia, but I mean, it's a long history. It is a Russian region and has been for almost as long as the United States, for example, has been in existence. It became part of Russia in 1783 under Catherine the Great, and you know, it was a very important part of Russia and then the Soviet Union. You know, the famous Yalta Conference, you know, where Churchill and Roosevelt and Stalin met, that was in Yalta, Crimea, which I visited, which is a quite idyllic and beautiful place. What happened, though, is in 1954, Khrushchev just decided to give the Crimea to Ukraine. I'm sure he had his reasons. But, you know, no one really cared that much because all of it was still part of the Soviet Union, and no one thought that was going to collapse. But here's the interesting fact that I learned when I was there. I didn't know this, Chris, until I went to Crimea. In January of 1991, so this is – the Soviet Union is still in existence at this time, but wouldn't be for much longer. You know, and at the end of the year, the Soviet Union would be essentially partitioned into the different republics. Well, in January of 1991, Crimea held a referendum to become its own autonomous republic, you know, to cut itself away from Ukraine and not to be part of Russia, but to be autonomous. And that referendum was passed and that was recognized even by Ukraine, that it was an autonomous republic. So the truth is, when the Soviet Union did collapse at the end of 1991, it should never have gone to Ukraine. It should have just been its own republic. And then when it decided in 2014 to go part of Russia. That should have been its own decision. I mean, the truth is Ukraine really never had, after January of 1991, any proper claim on Crimea. And that's an interesting fact that I didn't realize.
Well, and it's strategically vital for Russia. It's got a 12-month, a year-round seaport there, the only one in Russia. And it's a massive, I think it might be their biggest naval facility. And the British know this well, too, because they fought a war in the middle of the 19th century against Russia to try to take over the peninsula itself. I mean, it's a coveted area and has been for centuries.
Yeah, the famous Crimean War, which, as people pointed out, was a Russian war against France and England and other parties. It was not a Ukrainian war. And Tolstoy, the famous author, actually volunteered to fight for Russia. You had the Valley of Death there and the battle there.
The Charge of the Light Brigade.
The Charge of the Light Brigade that became a famous poem, I believe, by Tennyson. Yes, that's absolutely all true. And by the way, in terms of the naval base, Russia had that naval base even from 1991 until the referendum in 2014. That is, they had an agreement with Ukraine to maintain a naval base there. So Russia was always there, and they were at the city of Sevastopol, which I visited. And by the way, Sevastopol itself has an interesting legal existence. They themselves have a semi-autonomous power, even away from both Russia and Ukraine and Crimea. So that's an interesting thing too. So it's all very complex in a certain way. But essentially, the long and short of it is that Russia or Crimea is Russian in its language. Almost everyone speaks Russian there. Even the Ukrainians who live there and Tatars who live there, they speak it in their daily lives. And they have a Russian history, again, going back to 1783, that was only shortly interrupted by Khrushchev. And even then wasn't really interrupted, because really nothing changed by that gift to Ukraine, because, as I said, they were still being operated, you know, under the Soviet Union.
Well, if you just tuned in, you're listening to Guerrilla Radio. I'm speaking today with Dan Kovalik. Dan is a lawyer, educator. He's a labor, peace, and justice activist, a democracy defender, journalist, author, and a filmmaker. And he's just returned, and we're talking about his trip through Russia and into and around Crimea. Dan's latest book is Nicaragua, A History of U.S. Intervention and Resistance. Well, needless to say, Dan, to you at least, that the media and the governments of NATO don't appreciate the historical intricacies, complexities, or nuances of the situation in Crimea, or Russia generally for that matter, or if they do understand it, they choose to be ignorant of it. The most ignorant of it, of all of that, perhaps, is the Canadian government, whose official position, now you mentioned that the vote in Crimea, and this has been something that's stuck in my craw every time I hear it, even amongst leftists, they still say the same thing about the annexation. But the Canadian government's official position is, and I'll quote them, in March 2014, Russian forces occupied the Crimean Peninsula of Ukraine following the unconstitutional referendum on March 16th, 2014. President Putin signed a treaty purporting to incorporate Crimea into the Federation on March 18th. Canada, along with the international community, whoever they may be, continues to condemn Russia's illegal occupation and attempted annexation of Crimea. Annexation or legitimate federation? Dan, you've witnessed all kinds of these votes and elections all over the world. Can you straighten this out for me?
Yeah, well, I think it was a legitimate referendum, and I talked to people involved in the electoral committee that ran the vote there. And by the way, they ran it under Ukraine's rules, which is interesting because, again, Ukraine was at least the de facto power at the time the referendum was held. And you know, it's clear that people wanted to go back to Russia because they did feel threatened by the new regime in Ukraine, which was hostile, again, to the ethnic Russian-speaking peoples of their own country. And they voted to go back to Russia. You know, the UN Charter and various U.S. International legal instruments that flow from the UN Charter all make it clear that people have the right to self-determination, right? If they are unhappy being part of a certain nation, they are allowed to go their own way. And, you know, the hypocrisy around this is interesting. You know, the Western world, including the U.S. and Canada, recognized Kosovo as a breakaway republic from Serbia And they never even had a referendum, by the way. And in fact, they went, the U.S. really pushed for the International Court of Justice, also known as the World Court, to give an advisory opinion on Kosovo. And the U.N. Ruled that Kosovo could legally break away from Serbia, again, even though they didn't even have a referendum. You know, so – and of course, Russia points to that, saying, well, guys, you know, what's good for the goose is good for the gander. Here you actually had the people vote to go back to Russia. That should be respected. And again, when you look at – you can look at mainstream press articles from before 2022 where everyone agrees that people are happy with that decision. That is that the vote reflected what the people wanted. So they had the right to go back to Russia. And again, there's a huge question whether they were ever properly part of Ukraine after January of 1991 when they voted to become autonomous. So to me, it's not a matter of legalities that countries like Canada and the U.S. are hung up on. They just don't want Crimea to be part of Russia. That's all, period. They frankly don't care what the people of Crimea want. I mean, that's the saddest part about it. That's irrelevant to them. This is all about humiliating Russia, trying to weaken Russia, and they're happy to use Crimea as a pawn in that.
Well, and it reminds me of Canada not recognizing elections in Venezuela before they occur, and discounting other elections in countries that choose to go a different way than the Canadian government would choose. You mentioned the Tatars, the indigenous minority within Crimea. They were against during it was a wildly successful referendum on the federation side with Russia. The Tatar minority was an exception to that. That's being used in the West, saying that, oh, well, Russia is oppressing the indigenous minority. There's a claim that the human rights activist Abdurashid Zaparov, forgive the pronunciation, Mr. Zaparov, is being held, and he is an example that the people in general are being held down. What about this, that the Tatar resentment? You mentioned and photographed this amazing mosque being built, but does that translate into freedom for the people there?
Well, I think so. I mean, first of all, the other thing they did, aside just from building that mosque, they'd given land. This is all post-2014 after the referendum. The Russian government has given land to the Tatars that they actually protested to get, you know, land they wanted. Again, after 2014, Putin did a couple things as concessions to the Tatars. He rehabilitated them from the claims during World War II that they were collaborators, and also gave them some modest compensation for the displacement that they suffered under Stalin. A lot of the Tatars, or all of them, I guess, living in Crimea, were sent to different Soviet republics because Stalin had seen them as kind of would-be collaborators, kind of is how the U.S. treated the Japanese during World War II. And a lot of those Tatars have gone back to Crimea. And again, we're given land, we're given compensation. This mosque is being built for them by the Russian government. So the idea that they're being repressed is just absurd. And again, I think the Tatars now are pretty happy with how things are there. I think they're being treated much better now than they were by the Ukrainians, for example. But again, those are just things you don't hear about, you know. And if you went to Crimea, as I did, and traveled around the peninsula, I mean, you're just going to see that it's a very tranquil place and it's business as usual. People are filling the shops and the cafes and restaurants, going to work. I mean, there's no sign that it's being occupied by Russia or anything. You know, it's a self-functioning area that has its own municipal governments. It's this idea that somehow they're being repressed is just not true. And well, again, there's mainstream press articles debunking the claim that they're unhappy. Again, prior to to February 2022. After that happened, of course, the press just totally changes their tune on all that.
As they have on so many other things, the Nazi provenance of certain elements of the Ukrainian government being one of the most notable. Well, the same peaceful atmosphere can't be said of the Donetsk People's Republic or Luhansk People's Republic. I know you on a previous trip you went to both of these places. Did you get a chance to go to the eastern part of former Ukraine on this trip?
No, I had hoped to. Yeah, the last time I was able to go to Donetsk and to Mariupol, I was not able to this time. It's getting harder to go there.
Or have you communicated with any of the people that you met while you were there the first time and to find out what the current situation there is?
Yes, I continue to have, text my friends there. I mean, the situation is, again, in some ways better than it's been because there has been a lot of reconstruction done by the Russians once the referendums were held in September, wherein the four different republics voted to join Russia. So a lot of the damage that's been done, during the war has been repaired. But of course, Ukraine continues to shell those areas as well. So, reconstruction's done and then Ukraine shells them and, see have damage. So the shelling continues and it continues to do damage. So you have that happening. But I think in general, the people there feel more secure because at least they don't have these right-wing forces that had actually been able to invade their land, essentially, and they were arresting people and attacking people, killing people, torturing people. Those people, the Azov Battalion and others like them, have been removed from that area or killed. So.
Well, Canada, predictably enough, is consistent, and it says, quote, the fraudulent so-called independence referendums initiated by pro-Russian separatists were held May 11th, 2014, but gained no international recognition in the months following. Violence increased as Russia-backed insurgents clashed with the Ukrainian government forces, that is, in the two republics that were aspiring republics when that happened, and now are republics, even though not recognized by Canada, and the fighting goes on, and the war crimes go on that are never mentioned in the press here, at least in the state media.
Yeah, 14,000 people died in the conflict between the government of Ukraine and the Donbass before Russia intervened last year. That has to be pointed out. And this idea that these were Russian-backed separatists, they were Ukrainians of Russian ethnicity who themselves decided to, at that point, become autonomous. That's what they voted to do originally in 2014. Who formed their own militias to defend themselves. And those were the people who were fighting the government in Kiev that was attacking them. Did Russia provide them with some support? Yes, but it was not major support. And it wasn't Russia. Russia was not the prime mover there. It was the people of the Donbass themselves.
Well, and it was not major. It was not major support, and it wasn't timely either. And that was one of the big criticisms of Russia, that they sat idly for 8 years while the people there suffered under the onslaught of Kyiv. Sorry to jump in on you, Larry Dan, but we're fast out of time. Before we go, though, I imagine you're gestating all of your experiences and getting ready to publish something. If so, where can people find that to find out more information than we can provide in this limited venue?
Yes, well, you can follow me on Twitter at Daniel M. Kovalik, and I do have a piece coming out this weekend on RT International, which I'll also put on Twitter as well.
Well, Dan, I'm glad to have you back, and I'm looking forward to our next conversation.
Thank you, Chris. I really appreciate it.
And I want everyone else to stick around because Kim Goldberg's going to be straight up. We're going to talk about her event up there in Nanaimo this weekend, Saturday, May 20th. Thanks again, Dan.
Thanks, Chris.
Moscow, Tokyo, New York, Guerrilla Radio is everywhere at guerrilla-radio.com. Everywhere, all the time.
Well, welcome back to Guerrilla Radio. The epochal events roiling our world may seem to us to be all of the moment, but they are merely more of the same found under the sun ever. History waxes and wanes just as fortune, ever capricious, turns the magnificent to meanness in a twinkle. It is all illusion, a bubble blown and popped and done. What endures, though, are words of wisdom, verse uttered on a stage, prose printed on a page. It's a great and humbling realization to know our times will seem someday to some others as so many tempests in a char's pail. And if all that sounds to you like so much philosophy and all too poety, you ain't heard nothing yet. Kim Goldberg is a Nanaimo-based poet,